Hello, this is Devron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of March. This week, we're very pleased to have Dr. Fred Weinman joining us, here to speak with us about carnivorous plants. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you, Devron. It's always nice to be here.
We're always happy to have you. And Fred is an expert botanist with his specialty in the wetland plants of the Pacific Northwest. And we have been blessed to have his expertise, along with that of his wife, Anne, in helping guide our local Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society for many years. And in addition to being expert botanists, Fred and Anne are also avid birders and keen naturalists. So what have you guys been seeing out there of late? It's a great time of the year to be out.
Okay, so you mentioned birds. We spend a lot of time walking on the paths that are the easements in town. And this time of year, you know, people think pileated woodpeckers are really rare, but they're very noisy right now.
I don't think of them as being in town. I get them out where I am.
You don't
I have
need
a nesting
to be
pair.
In town.
Oh,
you
cool.
You can be right in the middle of town and you'll hear them, as long as you're in a wooded area. Yeah.
Uh huh.
And also, the plants are starting to show at the Kautai Prairie, of course.
You know, I'm going to go watch. Yeah. It's right across from the station,
yes.
So I'm going to go pop in there.
They're ready to pop.
Yes, the lomatium, the desert parsley.
Lomatium, the desert parsley, and the little iris. Well, we call it Olsinium, but it's a common name. I guess grass widow or different
things.
Oh,
that's a beauty. I love those. And, you know, I thought I heard a rufous hummingbird a couple of days ago, but
really?
I wasn't sure.
Okay.
You know, in the old days, if you heard a hummingbird, you would know it was a rufous, but now it could be an anna's.
Yep.
So I didn't get a very good listen. They usually come in about this time of year.
I really didn't know they came this early.
So. Yeah. You know, I saw the first salmonberry a couple of days ago, too. So it seems like usually when it's time for salmonberry and the red flowering currant, then the hummers
are... Yeah, the currant's out. A lot of the red flowering currant is out.
And I also saw a kestrel along the center road perched there above Short's Fields. And I love them. And we don't get them very often. This area.
Anytime you see a falcon, it's good.
Yeah, it's true. Well, before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. These mystery sounds were Fred's choice this week, and you are right. There are two very distinctive species calling, so we'll hear them again and tell you more about them at the end of the program. I do not imagine that I am alone in having a fascination with carnivorous plants. Ever since seeing the classic Little Shop of Horrors film on TV as a child, with the plant growing to the size where it could devour human beings... I have not heard of any species able to do this yet, but perhaps in time. How did you first come to be intrigued with carnivorous plants, Fred?
Well, just a minor addition. Some of them are big enough to capture things like mice, so...
Wow.
They're getting there.
Oh, yeah, in time.
But my interest is kind of a synchronicity between, you know, I've always been quite kind of a scholarly interest in Charles Darwin's work, and I'm interested in wetlands, and I'm interested in plants, and carnivorous plants grow in wetlands, and Charles Darwin wrote the first seminal work on carnivorous plants. So it all came together, kind of a synchronicity of those three things, botany, wetlands, and Darwin.
Well, and I didn't realize that Charles Darwin was fascinated with carnivorous plants.
His work in 1875 is still the most comprehensive, most seminal work that's ever been written on insectivorous plants, actually.
Wow.
He was a botanist. He wrote 5 books on botany. He established the characteristics which are the criteria for being a carnivorous plant, actually, in that work.
Huh. Well... He's a genius, what can you say? So what is required for a plant to be considered carnivorous?
There are three main things. And the first one is they need to be able to trap insects or other, you know, animals, small animals, even protozoans, even small animals. And they do this, you know, several different ways. We've mostly heard of the most famous one is probably the Venus flytrap. You know, two little hinged leaves that insect gets in there and they close on the insect. Everybody's probably quite familiar with those. And then the second one that people are probably most familiar with is the pitcher plants, which is a long, slim tube. This very complicated structure, actually. It has nectar glands at the top that attract the insects. Then it has a slippery area, so they slide down. And then it has reverse hairs pointing downward so they can't crawl out. And then it has glands down below for digesting the prey. So it's quite a complicated structure.
Wow.
And then the third one is the one that people around here are quite familiar with because, you know, it's our sundews. But once again, they are actually closely related to the Venus flytrap. But their leaves are just a flat surface usually, sometimes long and skinny, but they're usually a flat surface. And they have three kinds of glands. The outer ones are full of nectar and they attract the insects. And then there's another set of glands that digest the insect and another set of kind of bumpy things that are kind of a gland that absorbs the prey, the digested products of the prey.
I didn't realize that. I need to look more closely.
Yeah,
how sneaky.
Well, Darwin looked close, and he found all these things. And the third kind of trap is, you know, we call the Venus flytrap the snap trap. You know, we call the flypaper trap, is what we call. And then we have the suction traps, which are the bladderworts. And these are kind of inconspicuous to most people, but they're very common all over in our wetlands. And these little bladders that are often underwater or even underground, there's a negative hydraulic pressure inside them because there's no water inside them. And when the little insect gets real close, there's some trigger hairs. And when he hits those trigger hairs, the door opens and it sucks the insect into the bladder.
Wow.
And they have so many photos now, you can even get photos of little flies swimming around inside there after they've been captured.
Actually, I was just thinking that. I bet you there's video of how it gets sucked in. I didn't realize that it was vacuum process.
So that, you know, yes, what is required to be a carnivorous bladder. The first thing, they need to be able to trap insects. I kind of combine that all together. And the second thing, they need to be able to digest those insects. And once again, Darwin established this. He had a son, Francis Darwin, who was at Cambridge. And he was a plant physiologist. He was a chemist. So Darwin, he analyzed the products that came from these glands to show that they were producing digestive enzymes. And then he showed by analyzing the tissue in the plant that they actually had absorbed these nutrients from the plant. So the important part here is that for a carnivorous plant, they are photosynthetic, so they're not eating animals to live on like animals eat other animals or eat plants. They are eating animals strictly for the inorganic nutrients that they get from them, not for the carbon calorie energy that they get from them.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they have a split personality in that sense.
Well, and that was my other question is that carnivorous plants photosynthesize,
right,
but they supplement what they need.
No, it's not really a supplement. It's a totally separate because the two main sources of energy that all living things need. One is your inorganic nutrients, iron, manganese, you know, all the things. And the other thing is calories for energy. So they're not supplementing. They're actually getting their inorganic nutrients from the animals that they eat and their caloric energy they're getting from photosynthesis.
Yeah, that makes great sense because they're usually in nutritionally poor environments where they can't get their minerals their environment, from the soil.
That's right.
It's really poor drives them to...
That's exactly right. So most people think of, you know, when they think of a carnivorous plant, they think like a meat-eating animal or something.
Yes.
And really their purpose is quite different than that's it.
Yeah.
That's why these books for kids named, you know, Sweet and Sticky Foods and Trap Doors to Oblivion and things like that are really, from the insect's point of view, it is getting eaten, but not for its meat, you might say.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. And we usually think of carnivorous plants as living in exotic tropical environments, but we actually have several species right here on the Olympic Peninsula, right?
Yes, we do. We have about US, probably 40 or 50 species, you know, 10 of which are pitcher plants, and 20 of which are bladderworts. But in Washington, we have about 8 species of native carnivorous plants. But a problem is 5 of those, the little bladderworts that are in Washington, are mostly aquatic. And so people don't see them. But when they flower, you know, the flower looks a little bit like a violet. It's yellow and it's beautiful, but they just don't see them that often. And so we have about 5 species of those, and we have 3 species of sundews. And our common sundew, round-leaf sundew, grows everywhere you get to a bog in Washington, you'll find them. Gibbs Lake, Ludlow Lake around here, Cranberry Lake.
I went on a great field trip with you years ago, and I was astonished. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
You couldn't
step. They're really quite common.
They're just beautiful.
They're quite common.
These little jewels.
Yeah, they're quite common. Well, because the glands sparkle.
Yes.
And so they're nice. We see those. And then we have, of course, the one called the butterwort. Actually, the flower's identical, essentially, to a bladderwort. They're in the same family, but you'd never know it by looking at them, but they are. And in butterworts are more mountainous. In our seeps that on more or less vertical slopes, but also very common in fens and bogs, but higher elevation. And they are a flypaper type trapping mechanism, just sticky leaves, less diverse glands, but they still function the same as a sundew, but not as complicated.
So they've got sticky leaves, and do the leaves actually close over?
Okay, that's a good question, because in the sundews, they call them active fly traps, and the sundew leaves do close on the insect, whereas in the butterworts, they just stick and are dissolved in place, digested in place. So every time we go on the switchback trail, we always stop and see the butterworts in bloom. The first seep right at the beginning of the switchback trail is a ideal place to see them.
Well, they're so deceptive. They just do not look like they would be carnivorous plants. They look violet.
Yeah.
They just look like
what
you would expect.
Because a lot of plants that people think are carnivorous are not.
Yes.
And some that are carnivorous, you'd never know it. You know, some of the bromeliads, insects die in the bromeliad, but they're not really digesting and using the product of that insect. They need to stand. The way they do it now, of course, they have radioactive nitrogen or phosphorus, and they feed that to the insect, and then they feed the insect to the plants, and then they look in the plant and find out whether the plant actually took up that radioactive material. So that's the way they establish it now.
Yeah. So what kind of habitat types do carnivorous plants occur in? You were talking about bogs and other wetland areas. Is there always some kind of wet component?
Except for one species, yes. This lives in the desert, but that's an oddball. It's in Portugal, so it's very logical that, for one thing, they need a lot of light. Because the leaves are so modified, all their energy has gone into producing this very modified leaf, which is very inefficient photosynthetically. So they need a lot of light to produce enough carbon to live on. And of course, their roots are very poorly developed, so they need a lot of water in order to get enough water. They need a place that has a lot of water so the roots can be inefficient. And of course, these places are nutrient poor because they're acidic. So that kind of pushes them into wetlands, usually acidic wetlands, but not always, because under acidic conditions, other plants have difficulty taking up nutrients, so it gives them a competitive advantage to be in a place that's low, that has a low pH. So wet, high light, low pH.
And that is worldwide.
Every place you find them in the world, it's habitats to be seen. But they are worldwide. There are 1,500 species or so around the world, 45 U.S., 8 in Washington, 8 species in Washington.
Wow. And on the Olympic Peninsula, how many species?
Well,
I can see by the expression on your face.
No, I'm pretty close. I'm pretty close. There's 2 sundews, 1 butterwort, 3, and probably 4 bladderworts, but maybe only 3. So 7, probably 7 species. Ones we see are the sundews and the butterworts.
Yeah, because the bladderworts are underwater.
They are.
But I need to go find some and watch them because they sound fascinating.
This might only be interested to botanists, but butterworts and bladderworts are so closely related that many bladderworts that in Washington we think of them as aquatic plants, 80% of them grow just wet land like butterworts, and they look almost identical.
Wow.
We're familiar with what we see in our backyard, that's all.
Yes. So what non-native species occur in Washington?
Okay, well, that's been an interesting story because, these are plants that occur in very pristine-looking areas, but yet they're not native, and that's always surprising. You're out in a pristine area, and all of a sudden you see something not native. So the story kind of began in 1996. I heard a rumor that there were some purple pitcher plants at a summer lake in Skagit County, a little lake in Skagit County. And I thought, well, I should go and see, and I did. And, of course, somebody had reported that these were native, but actually the purple pitcher plants doesn't get any closer than Alberta to Washington, and most of the pitcher plants are in the southeast coastal plains. So I went and looked, and you're looking around, and you find these pitcher plants, which just don't belong there at all. We found 40 different plants of them. So we're snooping around there with a friend, and we looked around, and, oh, my gosh, over there is a white, tall, 3-foot-tall pitcher plant with a white top.
Wow.
So we kept looking. The next thing we saw was a tall yellow pitcher plant. And then we kept looking, and the first thing you know, we saw a cobra plant, or the Darlingtonia that lives in California, the pitcher plant that does not persist here over time. And then out of the corner eye, we saw this giant sundew, and it turned out to be a Venus flytrap. Okay. So all of these in the same little small area, which is quite shocking to a botanist that, knew that they were way out of place.
So did you find out what the backstory was with
those? Well, we think so, but we don't know for sure. There's a nursery in Snohomish, which does not exist anymore, that specialized in carnivorous plants. And we believe they're so close that they were using this area to outplant things to figure out which would survive so they could tell the customers which ones will live outside. And so when we went back in the year 2000, the white top pitcher plants had disappeared. The purple pitcher plants, there were still about 40 plants, and there were still about 10, Venus flytrap plants. By the way, Venus flytrap is so important, and it gets so rustled from the wild that they count every one. There are 300,000 remaining, incidentally.
Where are they native to?
South and North Carolina and one place in Florida.
Huh.
And so they're very, very in demand by the horticulturists.
Oh.
So in the year 2000, the cobra plant had disappeared, the white top pitcher plant had disappeared, and the Venus flytraps were still there, so I went back and kept...
Now, do you think that those were naturally...
They just can't persist.
They can't persist. They can't you don't persist. Think that someone came and
No, they've
them.
Tried to dig them out in various places. I've discovered purple pitcher plants in two other places in Washington, and the Forest Service tends to try and dig them out, but they're never successful in getting them all. But there, they've never done that.
Uh-huh.
But we went back in 2009 with the Native Plant Society, and the yellow pitcher plant had spread all over the lake. And this is a coastal plain plant that survived very nicely here, and it was all around the lake. And so then just last year, I kept going back, but now the beavers have built the dam so high, you need chest waders to get there. But there has become a concern, not because these plants are taking over the habitat, because they're capturing so many insects, they're impacting the pollinators.
That is the concern. Really interesting.
And when you cut them open, there's not just one or two insects. There's like 100 insects in there. It's full. These pitchers just get stuffed full. That's because they're just like birds that fly south because there are no more insects here. So they go south. Well, same thing. They collect food to last them through the winter. By storing this source of nutrition in their pitchers.
Wow, that's really interesting.
It's pretty interesting, yeah.
So do you think that that's a concern then?
Well, I don't think so. I think they're kind of charming interlopers, you might say, at this point, because we have looked very carefully, as carefully as we can, downstream from this lake, and we have not found any species, any non-native species. And this lake has lots of non-native species because other kinds were introduced sort of as vagabonds when they bring a plant back from someplace. It's got other plants with it.
Uh-huh.
And there are a number of other species there. None of them have we found downstream. And none of them are really, nobody's really worried about taking over the habitat, but they do have this pollination question. Nobody said we have to do something because you'd have to demolish the marsh to get them all out. So
it's not so much that they're competing with other plants for habitat,
right.
it's more the pollination concern, and that would affect birds and other animals.
It is unusual to have a place that looks pristine and you go out there and find all these weird plants, but if you're a botanist that loves all plants, it's hard not to kind of get a kick out of that.
So is there a concern regarding other non-natives spreading in that area?
Well, we've looked for all of them. We've never found them, but there are other ones. There's a cotton grass. There's several other species. In fact, I used to take classes from the University of Washington there just because it was an opportunity to see things they would not get to see anyplace else. I got back in 2018, but it was at the risk of my life.
Because the water's so deep now, you mean because the beavers...
These bogs always have a moat around them that's deep, and you have to get across it.
Well, another field trip. Sadly, we have run out of time for today, but for those of you who would like to hear more about the fascinating world of carnivorous plants, please come hear Fred speak on this topic at this month's meeting of the Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society. It will be held at the Port Townsend Community Center on Tuesday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. The social hour starts at 6:30 and the lecture starts at 7.
And a live pitcher plant.
Oh, in a live pitcher plant?
I think. Actually, pitcher plants are available from far reaches,
for example. They have beautiful plants there. And Kelly and Sue are supportive.
They're going to loan me them.
Yeah, great. And here's our mystery sound again. The first call is that of our native Pacific tree frog, and the second is that of the non-native American bullfrog. There's a problem with what we call these frogs, the native Pacific tree frog. Most professionals now accept Pacific tree frog, but others still go by chorus frog. I actually contacted two friends of mine that study amphibians, and one of them said, no, Pacific tree frog is now what's most accepted. Okay. And the other one said, well, I think Pacific chorus frog is more appropriate. So anyway, both are accepted and they are charming creatures.
Some people think they keep them awake at night, but I think they put you to sleep myself.
They're starting to ramp up.
Yeah, they're getting going now. They're heading towards the ponds for breeding, for egg laying. And so.
Yeah, so Fred chose them because we are starting to hear them now. Thankfully, we're hearing the tree frogs and not the bullfrogs. Bullfrogs have been recorded on the Olympic Peninsula, both on the Olympic National Forest and in the park. Have you ever heard any on the peninsula, Fred?
I have not.
They are very bad. They will eat anything that they come across. I've seen pictures of them ingesting ducklings. They usually thrive in warm waters of natural and man-made ponds.
Well, that's a good point, because in heavily urbanized areas where they build stormwater retention facilities, they get really warm and the bullfrogs thrive in there. And then when the pond overflows, they get into nearby ponds.
Uh-huh. They're native to the eastern U.S., but they were first introduced into Washington during... There are conflicting reports about that, but what I've mostly read is that they were introduced during the Great Depression in the early 1930s as a source of food. But then some people have pets and they let them, they release them into areas and then they get started. They can have up to 20,000 eggs in an egg mass. So,
well, if you do eat meat, you should be think of it as your duty to eat some. Then I guess
that's right. To go gather them up and
sort of like Himalaya blackberries, right?
That's right. So if you do find any, please report any sightings of the species to, I think the most current place is the Washington Invasive Species Council at invasivespecies.wa.gov. They're trying to control the spread of bullfrogs, especially in sensitive areas where they would compete with other species. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the first week of March. Thanks so much for joining us, Fred. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Closing music is Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog by Three Dog Night. Wishing you all happy trails.